The result of 18, though, is kind of interesting to discuss. How did you discuss it with her?
So what I told her was, based on the TAILOR-X data on the node negative patients that were postmenopausal, the result of 18 did not seem to give us a chemotherapy benefit. I discussed some of the node positive data, such as the SWOG trial, such as data sets from Sears, which is a large data set, that again pointed toward the direction that she would not get a benefit from chemotherapy. And so I think based on all of that data, she was comfortable not receiving chemotherapy.
And of course, you know, it's the sort of, I guess, biology versus maybe anatomy kind of thought. And it's interesting that you drew the analogy from the node negative to apply to her. And also, if you think about it, these data that we're going to talk about right now, looking at clinical higher risk and node negative, it kind of falls into that same biologic concept.
It really does. And we've had data with genomic assays such as Oncotype previously on the clinical risk versus the genomic risk. And what that data shows is, again, the clinical risk gives us prognostic data, but it doesn't give us predictive data. And with TAILOR-X, the same thing was shown, that the prognosis can be tweaked by using the clinical risk data, but prediction ends up being the same. And so when I look at all that data, I try to shield myself from that clinical risk and focus on the genomic risk and then focus on the chemotherapy toxicities. Because again, if you have a patient who you're giving a 2 to 3% benefit from chemotherapy, but based on their comorbidities, you think that the risks are higher, it's really not worth giving chemotherapy regardless of the benefit in the breast cancer recurrence. So those are the things that I kind of think about when looking at clinical risk versus genomic risk.
You know, it's interesting when you began, you were talking about the fact that you use the recurrence score more than the others because of the predictive data. And I was mentioning that our primary target here is the general medical oncologist. And I think you're seeing that throughout oncology. I don't know, I was flashing on CLL for some reason, you know, where there's like a million of these prognostic factors, but yet really there's only three that predict treatment, you know, del17p, p53, and IGVH. And those are the only three, and those are the ones right now that are being used in making clinical decisions. So it's interesting. I think really, I guess breast cancer really, I think, started this whole targeted therapy thing, if you really think about it.
I think so, too. Now, there is another school of thought that thinks that prognosis and prediction is similar. I don't agree with that. I think prognosis and prediction is different. And you can, again, look at Oncotype in the colorectal cancer arena, where they have good prognostic data, but prediction did not pan out. Again, showing that in my mind, at least, that I want to differentiate on what I want to achieve here. Do I want to achieve prognosis or do I want to achieve prediction? And based on that, I decide on what assay to use.
You know, I guess if you think about it in terms of prediction, I guess the first predictor we ever had in oncology was ER.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is a predictor. The only time I've heard an argument about prognosis that kind of was a little persuading was if through some kind of genomic assay you can show that the risk for recurrence is like less than 5% or less than 3%. So it doesn't really show a predictive thing, but, you know, like, well, you can't make it any better or risk the treatment is the same. What do you think about that? I've heard that applied sometimes with genomic assays.
And I think you're right. And when you look at the MINDAC data set, that's exactly
kind of
the point, right? That the prognosis is so good that how much better can we get?